The headlines: the Pentagon denies that a 2019 airstrike in Syria that killed many civilians was a war crime, saying no violation of the law of war occurred. Pro-Palestine activists mark the 74th anniversary of Nakba Day in several Latin American countries, holding rallies in solidarity with the Palestinian people. And Iran foreign ministry says in NATO's eastward expansion and the West's disregard for Russia's security are to blame for the war in Ukraine. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisumisha Ahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The U.S. Department of Defense says an investigation into the 2019 strike by American forces in Syria that reportedly killed many civilians has found no policy violations or wanted negligence. The probe focused on an airstrike by the U.S. forces on the Daesh bastion in Syria. The investigation was launched last year after the New York Times reported the U.S. military had covered up dozens of non-combatant deaths. The Times report says 70 people, of whom women and children, had been killed. A U.S. Army investigation, however, rejects that conclusion. The Times report also says that it calls administrative defenses delayed the U.S. military reports on the strike, giving the impression that it was being covered up. The Pentagon probe claims no, quote, disregard of civilian casualties occurred, plus it puts the number of civilian fatalities at only 4. Activists in Latin American countries hold events to mark the 74th anniversary of Palestine's Nakba Day, or the Day of Catastrophe. People in Peru, Panama, Chile, Argentina held rallies and marches in solidarity with the people of Palestine. The Venezuelan capital Caracas paid tribute to slain Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh by projecting her photo on the building of the Ministry of Housing and Urban Development. The Al Jazeera reporter was fatally shot by Israeli troops last week while covering a raid on the Palestinian city of Jenin. Abu Akleh's death touched off international condemnation of Tel Aviv's regime and its violence. The Iranian foreign ministry spokesman says NATO's eastward expansion and the West's disregard for Russian security concerns are to blame for the war in Ukraine. Said Khatibzadeh said NATO must realize that the confrontation does not have a happy ending. He also criticized the failure of the West to abide by the agreements that it struck with Russia. Moscow launched a war on Ukraine on February 24th, citing Kiev's failure to implement the terms of the Minsk agreement, first signed in 2014. Russia also pointed to security threats posed by NATO's eastward expansion and demanded guarantees that Kiev would never join the U.S. military bloc. NATO, however, rejected the request. Sweden and Finland are the latest in a bid to join NATO, despite warnings from Moscow. The Russian president criticizes European countries for imposing more sanctions on Moscow under U.S. pressure, despite the adverse impact of those bans on their own economies.
Today, we see that for absolutely politically charged reasons, because of their own ambitions and under pressure from their American overlord, European countries are imposing more and more new sanctions on the oil and gas markets. All this leads to inflation, and instead of admitting their mistakes, they look for the guilty party elsewhere.
Putin noted that Western sanctions and a possible EU embargo on Russian oil have pushed global prices up. He said such measures have already stoked inflation across Europe. Putin made the remarks during a televised meeting with a group of domestic oil managers and government officials. He said it is impossible for some European countries to completely shun Russian oil imports for now.
The Europeans openly admit that they cannot yet completely abandon Russian energy resources. Moreover, it's obvious that some EU states, in whose energy balance the share of Russian hydrocarbons is especially high, will not be able to do this for quite some time.
The Russian president also underscored the need for creating appropriate conditions for Russia's domestic oil producers in the face of sanctions. He pledged help for those companies, including facilitating access to loans, insurance, and Brussels had already imposed 5 rounds of sanctions targeting Russia's key sectors, entities, and individuals over the war with Ukraine. EU members are now negotiating a proposed oil embargo on Russia as part of the bloc's 6th package of bans. However, the latest round of their talks failed this week due to a veto by Hungary, which is heavily dependent on Russian oil. The cost of living crisis in the UK is worsening, and with it, the health of the British public. A new survey of more than 2,000 Britons has found that the pressure from the rising energy bills and other expenses is pushing many British households to the brink. Saeed Pureza reports.
As they go about their day, millions of Britons are consumed with one big question: how to make ends meet in the year ahead as the impact of the cost of living crisis kicks in.
It brings a lot of frustration because we know that energy companies, like very recently BP and other companies, are posting the highest ever profits. So it almost feels really unfair. And definitely it's going to have an impact on some families.
I can't even save in. Now you've got to allocate that money for other places, you know, for feeding your family, your kids. Everything's gone up. Petrol's gone up. So houses now, you might have to put that in a back burner or wait a bit until things better.
The cost of living crisis has barely begun, but the alarm bells are already ringing.
The numbers are pretty stark. Inflation is at a 30-year high. Thousands of people could face eviction, as that inflation could feed through into the housing market. More than 5 million Britons already have to choose between food and heating, as the Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey warns of apocalyptic food prices in the months ahead.
Not everyone is impacted. Bearing the brunt, low-income households, not only on their finances, but also on their health. The stress from soaring energy and food costs is preventing 1 in 2 people in Britain from looking after their well-being, with some even not affording to travel to hospital.
I can't sleep at night. Last night I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning and I've been up since then because of these prices. It's just, you know, what can you do?
The culprit for all this, a cocktail of Brexit, the pandemic, and the Russian military conflict in Ukraine. Britain was one of the first countries banning Russian energy imports. The impact of that decision now felt by the people here.
The government really needs to look into this thoroughly, how they can help people out there to find a job. People that have lost their businesses along the line, they need to look into that as well, how to maybe they need to sustain them, provide funding.
The UK government says it's providing support worth over $24 billion within the next year to help families with the pressures from the increasing cost of living. The big question is, will it work? Saeed Pourza, London.
Protesters gather outside the United Kingdom's Home Office to call on the government to block the extradition order of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the United States. Some 200 demonstrators staged a rally in London. Assange's wife says that his lawyers have submitted arguments that would help overrule the UK court order. It is now up to the British Home Secretary, Priti Patel, whether to extradite to the Australian whistleblower, although Assange's legal team will have 2 weeks to appeal a possible go-ahead. Assange is wanted in the United States for 18 criminal charges related to the release by the WikiLeaks of about 500,000 classified U.S. military records. If extradited, he could face life in prison. The UK announces plans to alter the terms of the post-Brexit trade deal for Northern Ireland despite EU warnings against any unilateral action.
I am announcing our intention to introduce legislation in the coming weeks to make changes in the protocol. Our preference remains a negotiated solution with the EU. And in parallel with the legislation being introduced, we remain open to further talks if we can achieve the same outcome through negotiated settlement.
The UK Foreign Secretary said a bill would be introduced in Parliament in the coming weeks to make changes to the so-called Northern Ireland Protocol, but she added that a legislative solution is not about scrapping the protocol and will remain in consistency with Britain's obligations under international law. The Northern Ireland Protocol was part of the UK's divorce deal with the EU. It effectively created a customs border in the area between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK to prevent a hard border on the island of Ireland. The EU says that any unilateral UK action on the protocol represents a clear breach of international law. It was warned that it will respond with all measures as a disposal goes ahead with the alteration.
It was supposed to ensure seamless post-Brexit trade between the UK and the EU. Instead, the Northern Ireland Protocol, in place since last year, is now in danger of falling apart, and with it, peace on the island. The most recent reason, the outcome of the elections in Northern Ireland earlier this month. The Republican Party, Sinn Féin, came top for the first time ever. The country has a system of power sharing between Republicans who want Northern Ireland in the Republic of Ireland and Unionists who wanted to remain in the UK. And the second largest party in these elections, the Democratic Unionist Party, refuses to accept the protocol, saying it undermines its position in the UK.
This protocol is bad for the economy of Northern Ireland. It's bad for the economy and the Union of the United Kingdom. And in our view, it is that Union of the United Kingdom which shelters Northern Ireland, protects Northern Ireland, provides opportunities for Northern Ireland.
This is the Irish Sea border for trade, enshrined in the Northern Ireland Protocol, part of a post-Brexit withdrawal agreement aimed at avoiding a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. The unionists here say they want the protocol scrapped altogether. Westminster now says it's prepared to make changes to parts of it, but to the EU, that is anathema.
The unionists say they're not entering into government with Sinn Féin if the protocol isn't resolved. And the EU says renegotiating an international agreement such as the protocol is simply not acceptable.
Unilateral action, effectively disapplying the protocol, is not the solution for the way forward. The Commission stands ready to continue working in this way because our ultimate goal is to protect the Good Friday Belfast Agreement in all its dimensions, and we urge the UK to do the same.
The UK has so far not budged. Instead, it's now threatening once again to pull the plug on the protocol altogether, leaving many wondering why it signed up to it in the first place.
Boris Johnson clearly wanted to get Brexit done, and so he promised just about anything to the unionists to get them to agree. At the same time, the unionists had a vested interest in staying good friends with the British, the Westminster government, because a rift with them would be very damaging for the unionist cause. Now they've got to live with those consequences.
It's a difficult, self-inflicted conundrum for the UK government, led by Prime Minister Boris Johnson, on a visit to Belfast trying to break the impasse. On the one hand, he has to satisfy the unionists to protect power sharing and that 1998 peace deal that put an end to decades of sectarian violence between the Republicans and unionists in Northern Ireland, and on the other, avoid a trade war with the European Union. Saeed Purza, Belfast, Northern Ireland.
The North Korean leader criticizes the officials' handling of a fever outbreak in the country. Speaking at a party meeting, Kim Jong-un said immaturity in the state's capacity to respond to the outbreak has exacerbated the crisis. North Korea has reported over 1.7 million cases with fever symptoms, as well as more than 60 deaths. While North Korea reported its first COVID infection last week, it has yet to reveal how many people have tested positive for the coronavirus. The country's leader has already branded the outbreak the biggest turmoil the republic has experienced since its foundation. The UN envoy for Yemen calls for extending a long-sought truce in the country, which will expire in 2 weeks. He said that the ceasefire has significantly reduced violence in Yemen and helped improve the living conditions. The two-month UN-brokered truce went into effect in early April. Speaking at the end of a closed UN Security Council meeting, the envoy said that there have been no aerial attacks from Yemen and no confirmed airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition. He also said that more needed to be done to contain the crisis in Yemen as part of the truce. The first commercial flight in nearly 6 years left Yemen's capital on Monday. He also said that another flight was scheduled for Wednesday. Official results from Lebanon's parliamentary elections show independent candidates have made unprecedented gains in Sunday's polls. According to the Interior Ministry, independent candidates won at least 13 seats in the 128-member assembly. They campaigned against Lebanon's ruling elite and vowed to bring about reforms. The resistance movement Hezbollah and its allies won 62 seats but lost their majority. Hezbollah opponents, including the Saudi-aligned Lebanese forces, a Christian faction, gained ground. The results leave parliament split into several camps, with none of them having an absolute majority. Well, that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The assassination of Shirin Abu Aghele places an onerous responsibility on the shoulders of journalists armed with their microphones and cameras to not flinch in the face of brutal suppression, says Iqbal Jassat, writer, in an article published under the heading Shirin Abu Aghele Personified Truth to Power. Stay tuned for more. Since the brutal killing of one of Palestine's most iconic journalists, an unmistakable sense of anger has surfaced across newsrooms in the Arab world and in many parts of the world, including South Africa. Shirin Abu Aghele had been on assignment covering the settler colonial regime's military assault on Jenin within the occupied Palestinian territory when she was assassinated in cold blood. From eyewitness accounts by her colleagues who were on the beat with her, it is clear that Shirin was specifically targeted. Her death was neither accidental nor the result of a firefight between Palestinian resistance and the occupying regime. She died due to premeditated plan by the Bennett regime to assassinate her. Shirin Abu Aqila's profession required impeccable, accurate, and honest reporting, which she discharged with great integrity. Her courage and determination to bring into the living rooms of millions of people in the Arabian Peninsula and beyond the unspeakable horrors flowing from the Zionist regime's illegal occupation stood as a bulwark against the Zionist regime's goal to avoid public scrutiny. Her on-the-spot coverage of daily violations by the apartheid regime, including detentions, home demolitions, military raids, and killings of Palestinians, placed her in the crosshairs of the Zionist regime's terrorist army. Born and raised in Al-Quds, Shirin Abu Aqila knew every nook and corner of occupied Palestine as well as 1948 Palestine. Her grasp of the territories, including her vast knowledge of the history associated with the Nakba, made her an invaluable part of Al Jazeera's team. Resourceful and professional to the core, Abu Aqila's iconic status was unrivaled. Tributes that have poured in and continue to abound via social media and mainstream platforms acknowledge her profound humanity. In honoring her legacy, media houses and the entire fraternity who are serious about journalism will need to discard the fear of being smeared as anti-Semites by courageously reporting the reality of the fabricated regime of Israel's brutality. The shock and horror of the Zionist regime's savage attack on the funeral procession in full view of a global audience cannot be reduced to clashes, as some media reports suggest. To describe a full frontal violent assault by armed Israeli regime troops on mourners carrying Shirin Abu Aqila's casket to her final resting place as clashes is not only deceptive, but an insult to her memory. It needs to be called out as a blatant violation of her right to a dignified and peaceful funeral. The assassination of Shirin Abu Aqila places an onerous responsibility on the shoulders of journalists armed with their microphones and cameras to not flinch in the face of brutal suppression. Her untimely death has allowed the world to witness a colonial settler regime that to date has escaped consequences for its gross violations and abuses of fundamental human rights. Unless this changes, expect the Zionist regime's illegal occupation and war crimes to continue unabated. The agency of change possessed by media activists must thus be fully utilized. It cannot and dare not be a passing phase which is obliterated and forgotten once the cameras move on. We owe it to her and thousands of journalists across the world to ensure that their unique role in highlighting injustice, oppression, and abuse of power remains as a testament of commitment to truth and integrity. As a journalist at Al Jazeera for more than two decades, Shirin had become a household name among millions who loved, respected, and deeply revered her professionalism. South Africa has been no exception. In a fitting tribute, Palestinians as a collective mourn her loss by reminding us about the special place Shirin Abu Aqila had in their lives since 1997, bringing to their homes the horrors of the occupation and the courage of those resisting it. Her reports debunked, indeed ridiculed, the official Israeli regime narrative about the daily human rights abuses in the West Bank and inside the occupied territories. No wonder she was targeted while doing what she always did, speaking truth to power. Her reports will be an essential part of the archives of Palestine in general and that of the occupation in particular. This they will not be able to kill or erase.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and since today is the day following the Battle of Uhud, in which Hazrat Hamza, peace be upon him, the Holy Prophet's valiant uncle, was not just tragically martyred, but his liver torn from his body and chewed by an Arab infidel, let us listen to the Holy Prophet's saying on the importance of pilgrimage to the graves of the righteous. Whoever visits my grave, but does not visit the grave of my uncle Hamza, has indeed been unkind to me.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, behavior with the neighbors. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of behaving with the neighbors in the Islamic lifestyle. When we say that in the Islamic teachings, there is a lot of emphasis on having a good relation with the neighbors and giving the rights of neighbors and taking care of the neighbors, then obviously there are some behaviors that we should have in relation to our neighbors. And amongst those relations in the teachings is to have a good behavior with them. And we need to do ihsan the way we do ihsan or goodness to our parents We need to have this good behavior with our neighbors at all time. On the other hand, when we are living at a place, we need to make sure that our neighbors are not disturbed because of us. For example, if our kids are there, if we are having guests, or maybe if we are leaving the house or coming back to the house, it should be in a way so that our neighbors are not getting disturbed. For example, you know, in the West, I know that people are living in the sharing houses as well. Maybe there are the students, so I'm just going to give you an example of the students. For example, students, they rent a room in a house where there are other people that are also living. So we should enter into house in a way so that if our neighbors, maybe they are sleeping, maybe they are having guests, maybe they are doing something and they do not want others to disturb them. So we need to enter the house and exit in a way so that they are not getting disturbed because of us. Maybe not closing the door or shutting the door hardly or strongly so that it makes a noise. So we need to make sure that we are taking care of them and we are not disturbing them in any way or any kind in which it will be an insult towards them. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of behavior with the neighbors in the Islamic lifestyle. And we said we should behave in a way so that they are not disturbed because of us. And they feel peaceful when we are there. On the other hand, there are other things to do. For example, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, when he raised his hands, he used to pray for the neighbors. And the best thing about the neighbors is the best pray for the neighbors is that we need to have first the Muslim neighbors, the one who are same in the religion with us. And on top of that, when he used to pray that Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. And then he used to say, وَتَوَلَّنِي فِي جِيرَانِي وَمَوَالِي الْعَارِفِينَ بِحَقِّنَا. O Allah, make our neighbors the one who has our love, the love of Ahlul Bayt, alayhimu salatu wasalam. وَالْمُنَابِذِينَ لِأَعْدَائِنَا بِأَفْضَلِ وِلَايَتِكَ. And they are the enemies of our enemies. So the love of Ahlul Bayt and having a love or showing the love towards Ahlul Bayt, it is one of the prayers that we can pray for our neighbors that they also are from the lovers of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salatu wasalam. And they are also from those who hate the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt. Why? Because Ahlul Bayt are the role model. They are here for reaching us in order to take us towards the perfection. So if we have the love of those who takes us towards the perfection and we are having or we want to have this journey of perfection, if we have such neighbors next to us, it will be easy for us to have the same journey and they can also accompany us in the same journey. So therefore, this is very important. And the main point is to pray for your neighbors, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
A group of over a dozen penguins has been released back to the sea after being given a second chance to live.
The condition of these specimens, which fortunately could be reinserted, is very common to find. They are animals that appear stranded on the coast, found with malnutrition, dehydration, hypothermia, and a high degree of parasitism. Specialists call this condition the stranded penguin syndrome.
The penguins were rescued and taken to the Mundo Marino Foundation, where they were rehabilitated. They were kept warm and were fed liquids until they could eat fish again. Before their release, blood and other samples were taken, and a chip was implanted to track them. One of the penguins was a southern rockhopper, which is a species listed as endangered. Biologists at a rescue center say there are many reasons why penguins get stranded and malnourished. These include overfishing, global warming, and other environmental changes. Thousands of people crowd into the British city of Norwich to watch a 2-kilometer-long string of dominoes topple, while winding through town. Some 7,500 breeze blocks were set up for the event. The dominoes slinged through street buildings, windows, and even climbed up stairs and trees. The toppling lasted 30 minutes. The moving sculpture was installed across the city with the help of some 200 volunteers. The artistic director said the work was chosen partly because it was a spectacle and both disrupted the city and engaged its people.
There's a sense of anticipation that goes with the work. You will have seen people around town at the moment. Everybody's asking, what's going on? And then when they realise what it is, then there's this sense of, oh, and when are you going to knock it over? So that it's a sculpture also that gets destroyed in many ways, and that's really part of the work as well. I mean, I like to think about it as a child almost playing with the city. You know, they're setting everything up, and we all know they're going to knock it down at some point, and that's fun.
Daniel Bryan said he was excited about the project because it looked like a child had taken over the city with the joy of knocking down dominoes. The cascading dominoes ran through two cities, eventually ending at the site of Norfolk and Norwich Festival of Arts. The organizers say the goal of the installation was to bring unity to the community. Chilean paleontologists unearthed a rare, fully intact fossil of what is known as a sea dragon discovered from a melting glacier deep in Patagonia.
It is the first complete and excavated ichthyosaur that has been found in Chile. It also corresponds to one of the most complete fossils ever found on the planet for the Cretaceous period. It is the only pregnant ichthyosaur that's been found on the planet from the era between 129 and 139 million years ago. So it's incredibly important.
The 4-meter-long fossil is nicknamed Fiona and swam the seas some 250 million years ago. Scientists say this specimen will help them understand this species and its embryonic development. The expedition lasted over a month because of the remote nature of the find in the Patagonian glaciers. Paleontologists had to make a 10-hour hike just to get to the site. They also had to camp in extreme weather conditions while maneuvering tricky, rocky surfaces. But collecting and transporting the fossil was a whole other story.
As we went down excavating, weakening the rock, we realized the skeleton was mostly complete, so much that the bones were pushed inwards and we had to make 5 blocks of approximately 200 kilos each to move it.
The blocks were then airlifted to the Rio Seco Natural History Museum in southern Chile to be prepared for exhibition. The fossil was first discovered by Ruth Pedro more than a decade ago, but because of the site's harsh terrain, its extraction was a complex challenge. Scientists also discovered over 20 other specimens of the same species during the expedition, bringing the total found in the glacier area to 100. We'll be right back.
stopping by and listening to street musicians usually changes our mood for the rest of the day. The experience would be different if one lies under the instrument while it is being played. And that's exactly what a pianist in America has done. Colin Huggins, a busker, wheels his grand piano more than a half a mile from a mini storage to New York's Washington Square Park. He lets people lie down under the instrument and feel the vibrations from the claviers in their bodies. Colin says he wants to help people recover emotionally from the intense disconnect they had faced during COVID lockdowns.
I've always wanted to accommodate feelings in the best way possible, and I wanted to do it with music, and this is the best way I figure out how to do it. Maybe someday I'll figure out a way to do it even better, and I won't need to push this piano here. But as of now, this is the best I've got.
New York was one of the hardest hit cities by COVID in the U.S. Like other places, the major city imposed lockdowns and tough curbs to contain the virus. Despite that, Colin continued playing on the streets, frequently to an audience of zero. He says he strongly believes that everything will be okay. Cambodian fishermen aiming for small fish were shocked to see the surprise catch tied to their hook. This creature was nothing but an endangered giant freshwater stingray, which had swallowed the fishermen's catch. It was 4 meters long and weighed 180 kilos. The female leviathan is one of the rarest species of fish in Southeast Asia. Therefore, a team of international experts helped unhook the stingray to release it back to the waters unharmed.
All right, so we've just released our giant stingray back into the wild. She's kind of hanging out on the surface of the river here. It's amazing to be able to see her swimming around in her natural habitat and to have participated in the release of this giant stingray today.
The giant stingray was caught in the Mekong River, an important habitat for different species of fish, including huge catfish and barb. However, experts say the river's underwater ecosystem has been damaged by massive plastic wastes. Environmentalists constantly warn that building dams on the Mekong River is also destroying its large fish stock.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Scaling Mount Everest is only a dream for many and a once-in-a-lifetime achievement for most professional mountaineers. Well, not for this Nepali Sherpa, who has now repeated the feat for a record 26th time. 52-year-old Kami Rita led a group of other Sherpa climbers along the traditional Southeast Ridge route to the world's tallest peak. In the process, he beat his own previous record set last year. Rita first scaled Everest in 1994 and has been making the trip nearly every year since then. The Sherpa community is an ethnic group indigenous to the Himalayan region. They are expert mountain navigators who also carry heavy loads. Everest stands nearly 9,000 meters above sea level. The mountain has been climbed more than 10,000 times since it was first scaled in 1953. The bad news is more than 300 people have died trying. Chinese scientists are establishing a meteorological monitoring station at an altitude of 8,800 meters on Mount Komolangma, the world's highest peak on the China-Nepal border. The 13 members of the research team started the trek towards an 8,300-meter base camp on Mount Kololangma from a 7,028-meter camp on Tuesday morning. They reached the camp in the afternoon and went on the last section of the arduous journey up on Wednesday morning. It replaces the one at an altitude of 8,430 meters set up by the British and US scientists on the mountains in 2019. While some drivers are obsessed with the speed, some others have a passion for the look of their cars. In Tehran, car tuning lovers have assembled for the biggest show of modified vehicles. Yusuf Jalali has the story.
Fast and furious. It's the biggest show of personal cars turned SUVs. Held in Tehran's Island Karting Track, the event brought together more than 500 motorists to flaunt their modified cars.
This is the only place where car tuning lovers can vent their energy and show off their beautiful cars. When I saw the call for such a big assembly of modified vehicles, I didn't waste a moment and decided to bring my car here.
Exhausts sound deeper, with flames popping out. Sound systems rattle the car roofs. And regular doors are replaced by butterfly doors, opening upward. To these people, car tuning is more than a hobby, but a passion. Majid says he has spent double the price of this Peugeot 206 to turn it into a green beast.
For us, our cars mean everything. To me, it's love. I save whatever I earn to spend on my car. So I urge the police to respect this love and stop fining us when we roll with our cars on the streets.
Based on Iran's traffic regulations, drivers are not allowed to alter the original design of their cars. Installing loudspeakers and noisy exhaust systems, and even attaching stickers, are associated with fines. Omid says he can't take this. He has transformed his Iranian-made car, dubbed Rana, into a whole new model, saying it looks better now on the street.
I spent whatever I could afford to make the streets look better with our cars, but the police are treating us like we are wrongdoers. I myself oppose dangerous driving in the city. What I want is just to make my car look more attractive.
Car tuning encompasses any modification to a vehicle that would lead to a higher engine performance and dynamic handling of the car. As long as these people stick to these rules, police will not have issues. Otherwise, they must keep these beauties inside their parking lots.
Thank you. However eye-catching they are, these mutated cars are no longer road pets and are good for drifting on tracks like this. Organizers say that's exactly why they held this show, to provide a chance for car tuning maniacs to vent their energy in a safe place. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski aims to maintain a Senate seat in November's midterm elections as she faces off against an opponent endorsed by former President Donald Trump. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Jason Lemon. The article has been published by Newsweek. The piece is titled Lisa Murkowski's Chances of Beating Trump-backed Rival, According to Polls. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski aims to maintain a Senate seat in November's midterm elections as she faces off against an opponent endorsed by former U.S. President Donald Trump. Senator Murkowski, widely viewed as a centrist Republican, drew Donald Trump's ire after she voted for his conviction, along with six other GOP senators, in a Senate impeachment trial after he was charged with inciting his supporters to attack the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January 2021. In June of last year, the former president officially backed Kelly Shibaka in her bid to unseat the Alaska senator. Last November, the Alaskan senator confirmed she'd seek another six-year term. Despite Donald Trump's endorsement of Kelly Shibaka, recent opinion polls suggest that Lisa Murkowski is still well-positioned to hold on to her seat. However, Alaska is also implementing a new nonpartisan ranked choice primary system, as well as ranked choice general election ballots this year, making final results less easy to predict with some accuracy. Analysts have speculated that the new system could benefit Lisa Murkowski. Polling conducted from 16th to 21st of April by Alaska Survey Research showed that Lisa Murkowski leading Kelly Shibaka by double digits, 10 percentage points among likely voters in Alaska. The survey showed the incumbent with the support of 55% of likely voters compared with just 45% who backed Kelly Shibaka. The survey questioned 1,208 respondents and had a margin of error of plus or minus 2.9 percentage points. A previous opinion poll carried out from 14th to 16th of March boded better for Kelly Shibaka. The Trump-backed challenger was narrowly ahead of Lisa Murkowski by 2 percentage points in that survey by Signal, which was commissioned by Shibaka's campaign. The GOP senator, Lisa Murkowski, received about 49% of the vote, as opposed to her rival's approximately 51%. 500 Alaskans were surveyed. While the most recent Alaska Survey Research poll showed that Lisa Murkowski was well-positioned compared with Kelly Shibaka, the survey also demonstrated a notable decline from a previous one conducted last October. That autumn poll of 969 registered voters put the incumbent 20 points ahead of her opponent. Lisa Murkowski had the backing of 60% of the voters, compared with just 40% for Kelly Shibaka. Under Alaska's new ranked choice system, whether Murkowski or Shibaka is the most popular candidate among Republicans will have less of an impact. The nonpartisan primary system the state is implementing allows the top four candidates, regardless of party affiliation, to advance to the general election. Website 538 assesses that Alaska has a 14.6 percentage point partisan lean in favor of Republicans. However, meaning that conservative voters are expected to be the dominant force in November's general election. At the same time, Lisa Murkowski does not have to worry about being defeated in a GOP primary. She just has to make it into the top four in the nonpartisan primary on 16th of August in order to appear on November's ballot. The new system also allows for voters' second, third, and fourth choices of candidates to potentially receive their backing if no contender wins more than 50% in the first round of counting. The Alaska Division of Elections website explains, the last place candidate from each race in round one is eliminated and their supporter's second choice selection is allocated to the remaining candidates on the ballot. This vote redistribution process continues until one candidate reaches over 50% of the votes, or until two candidates remain and the candidate with the most votes wins. In each round of counting, each voter gets one vote. Analysts have said this system could benefit Lisa Murkowski, as she may receive the backing of independents and moderate Democrats. While these voters may not list her as their first choice, they may mark the GOP senator as their second or even third choice. Depending on how much support each candidate receives in the first round, she could come out on top in a second or third round of counting. Notably, Senator Murkowski has previously demonstrated the ability to buck the odds and win in her state of Alaska. In 2010, she won re-election as a write-in candidate after she lost in the state's GOP primary. At the time, she was the first senator in more than five decades to win as a write-in candidate.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. Every year in the month of May, we remember the Nakba, or catastrophe, when in 1948, Zionists forced 750,000 Palestinians from their homes at the point of a gun. Of course, the Nakba didn't start in 1948. Palestinians were being displaced for decades before that. Furthermore, since the 1930s, Palestinian civilians have faced terror attacks by armed Zionist gangs. And the Nakba didn't end in 1948 either. Later in the show, we'll be looking at how Zionist forces are trying to censor and distort textbooks for school children in the hope that they'll never properly understand the Palestinian struggle. As always, I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more. But first, we've got this special report by Bianca Rahimi.
The 15th of May is a date etched in infamy, Nakba Day, the commemoration of the expulsion by Zionist terror of approximately 750,000 Palestinians. About 530 villages were ethnically cleansed and either destroyed or given new Hebrew names so that they could be colonized by Jews. For Palestinians, the Nakba is a continuing process still happening, indeed intensifying today. It is well known that the colonial power Britain was responsible for allowing the establishment of a settler colony in historic Palestine. Less well known is that recruits for the Zionist terror militias to take part in the Nakba came from Britain and other Western countries. In Britain, the Jewish Agency set up a secret